Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about multi-party campaigns. Can a DM handle multiple groups in a single fantasy world, and how much is too much today on Wandering DMs? Paul, not to sound like a broken record, this is an issue I was looking to get extra ideas for, because I had some ideas for a campaign recently. This is what became the sticking point for me, is how in the world am I going to handle possibly interactions between multiple groups? I'm going to read one little thing here. If I pull up the very first volume ever of D&D, when people open this book, usually the first thing that just absolutely blows their mind is the number of players section right here. And I'll just read it if you don't know what that says. Number of players, Dungeons and Dragons takes at least one referee, and from 4 to 50 players can be handled in any single campaign. Lovely. And so a lot of people go, 50 players in a campaign. Now, admittedly, they wouldn't be all at the table at one time. Gygax there was thinking about having multiple groups and multiple people showing up on different days. And they'd probably be larger groups than we deal with today, like maybe up to maybe 20. But again, the assumption for D&D starting on day one was that there'd be more than one group. And nowadays, it's hard for me to wrap my head around how that works.
Fascinating. So how do we know that this is the way that Gygax ran? Where's that coming from?
I think we have stories that people have told, places like EN World and places like the ODD 74 forums, that when the game was first invented, Gary was running games every single night in his basement, 7 nights a week, and there was so much excitement, it was just nuclear powered, and people were cramming into his basement on a regular basis every night, and there'd be different people from night to night. And I believe that you'd form groups, go into the dungeon, and we also have stories from Dave Arneson that he had people showing up in person, and then people that couldn't show up on person, they would be calling him on the phone at night. Can I do something with my character, Dave, on the phone? And he was having to handle that. So we have a lot of stories that both Dave and Gary were handling that.
I remember hearing that latter story, I think, from Dave McGarry at GaryCon when you and I were there. That story. Yeah, fascinating. Very, very interesting. Certainly not the way most people play the game these days.
If you're a DM and you've put your heart and soul into making a rich campaign world, you kind of want to show it off more. So I feel like a lot of us have the instinct that we would like an opportunity to get more depth like this and get more perspectives from different play groups at the same time. But it's a hard problem. I think many of us have attempted something like this and really cracked the boat open on the shoals, because this is a hard problem, honestly.
Now, do you think this comes ultimately from, I assume, from wargaming tradition, right? That like these groups of people that he's playing with are mostly from wargame clubs, where they're used to this is basically how you add context to your wargame, right? If we're just going to sit down and play whatever the French versus the Germans in a World War II game, we played a game, great, that's fun. And then the step that often came after that was like, well, let's actually have a map and show territory control. And when we resolve a game, whoever won will shift where the line is. And then we have context for many battles over the course of a war.
Right. I think that's very true. And of course, D&D originally, before the role-playing name was invented, called itself Medieval War Games Rules. Certainly the sensibility at that time, and we get that from Arneson's Blackmoor campaign, is that the players are not necessarily allies Maybe they're competing. Maybe they're competing against each other in that same war game sense. And, you know, Paul, I was this morning I was reviewing Tony Bath's famous book, Setting Up a War Games Campaign, that came out 1 year before D&D did. So it's certainly in the zeitgeist. And basically what you just said, Paul, was pretty much the preface of that book. Tony Bath writes exactly that. Is you're going to be, you've played a couple games, they're disconnected, and now you want something that's a little bit deeper that has ongoing connections. Mm-hmm. A lot of people make mistakes at this point, is what he says. Let's go through the common mistakes. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. I'd be very curious what the common mistakes are, but that's maybe for another show. fascinating. I've played in war games like that. Usually through work, where had a group of people who are all in the same space together already, and we're like, oh, we'd love to play, you know, Warhammer during lunch or whatever, and so let's start doing that, and then we're like, well, now we want the context, so yeah, let's set something up. Makes sense, especially when you're.
Yeah, I will say that Bath's initial stab at that is just that people make it too complex to begin with, too complex to handle. So his recommendation is start simple, and if that campaign goes well, then think about what elaborations you can go on the next one. How did that work for your workplace Warhammer game? Was it simple or complicated to start with?
I mean, it was probably complicated, right? We were playing a couple one-off games, and then the idea was let's have a bigger game. So eventually sort of rules were formulated, a map was drawn, you know, okay, we got a hex map, and now we can argue about who controls which hex. Maybe that gives you access to resources so you can alter your army throughout the course of play. The fact is, in my experience, the problem is that the personal interest level or energy that different players are putting into the game varies greatly. And so you end up with like a couple players who just want to play all the time, and a couple other players who are harder to pin down, right? Who are playing just a little more with a little bit more of a casual mindset. And that's difficult to balance. That's very difficult to balance. And so usually it fell apart through the scheduling.
Gotcha.
Right. If you want the overall game to be balanced, then everybody's got to get in a certain minimum number of actual games. Right. And then, you know, somebody becomes the linchpin for that. Oh, so-and-so still hasn't played any games yet. I don't know. What do we do about that?
It feels like this is the hard problem. And to me, so that's a situation where you have two different scales of the game, right? You have the strategic map that you're talking about. Yep. And then when conflicts happen between players, then you have to separately schedule a special event for the tactical action of what happens when those two people...
Right.
Now, again, and to my right before the show, what I said is, well, that's only two people. That's only two people that need to play a game of Warhammer.
Yeah.
That should be very simple. Should be simpler than like having like two separate D&D play groups where you need to get like 8 or 10 people together. And
you can expand this out. I played in a game of an extended campaign of Mordheim, which is the Games Workshop's Warhammer Fantasy setting game that's squad-based rather than huge armies. So you're controlling maybe 5 or 6 individual characters, you know, small band, rather than a huge army. The interesting thing about that game is it takes a little less space. It's slightly different. You know, maybe the entry is a little easier because brand new players only have to paint 5 miniatures instead of, you know, 500.
Right.
So it's a little easier to get into. And then the interesting thing is the context in that is not a big map. We're not emulating battles in an army. We're emulating little skirmishes between small bands who are roving around a destroyed city. So the context is in the band itself. So there's a lot of rules for advancement, like what happens at the end of a battle. Was this character actually killed or are they wounded? Do they need to be healed? Do they gain experience points that they can spend on new skills? You know, do you want to buy up new members or more equipment for your little war band, et cetera, et cetera. But there was still this strategic level thing. And again, like, you know, a player could get ahead just by playing a lot of games. And that's usually disappointing to most players. It's like, oh, it's just, you know, whoever plays the most wins, that sucks. But the interesting thing about that is you could also that is not necessarily always one versus one. You could have matches that were two on two or like a four person free for all, etc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Was it like so I played, I guess a friend of ours used Mordheim as a setting for some D&D games we played, but I didn't play in the Mordheim campaign. Is there a strategic level and a tactical level, or is it just like when you have a fight, it's all in the same place, basically?
Well, the fight is all in the same place, just like any Warhammer game, right? You're sitting down at the table and you're playing the battle between, you know, two groups or whatever, three groups, however many. So, I mean, I think the strategic level was, again, just the context of how do we arrange the games? Who plays against who, when, and why? Right? Like, what's the...
Right.
I think it's meant to be a little more loosey-goosey, I think, honestly. So Mordheim specifically rolls this out in their rule book, but I think it's more just like, oh, you just challenge another player. Hey, let's go play a game. Okay, great, right? So there's, you don't have to worry about like, well, are we adjacent on the map? Are we, what territory are we fighting over? Like, because all the persistence is in the band itself, right? Mm-hmm. So like, oh, I want to get on the board so that my band can move around and maybe find some resources. And then bring those home, and now I have those resources to spend on upgrading them.
That's exactly what I was wondering about.
Yeah. So you do have that little bit of strategic element of I want stuff, and I want to increase the ability of my warband. But the rules around actually getting onto the board were looser.
Yep, I can see that. That would make that streamline. You know, I'm looking at the chat that's going on right now, and it's like, to me, again, this seems like a hard issue of how to handle multiple parties in one campaign. And I am really searching for anybody's advice myself. Now, our friend Julian is saying that he did in fact run a campaign at one point with 50-ish players. So if Julian wants to like share any extra stuff about like, did he have two separate like strategic tactical level there or what made that feasible? I think a lot of us would be really curious about hearing that. Maybe we should have Julian as a guest today.
I feel like the style of game we're going to end up talking about here is West March's campaign, which tries to emulate sort of what we think of when Gary was writing about that kind of 50 players and multiple things and whatnot. Let's see. Do I still have this here? Yeah, I just posted. I have the original blog post written by Ben Robbins about the West March's campaign. So let me just read a little bit here for a setup for anyone who doesn't know what the hell it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a campaign. It says it was designed to be pretty much the diametric opposition of the normal weekly game. One, there was no regular time. Every session was scheduled by the players on the fly. Two, there was no regular party. Each game had different players drawn from a pool of around 10 to 14 people. Three, there was no regular plot. The players decided where to go and what to do. It was a sandbox game in the sense that's now used to describe video games like Grand Theft Auto, minus the missions. There was no mysterious old man sending them on quests, no overarching plot, just an overarching environment. And he says, my motivation in setting these things up this way was to overcome player apathy and mindless plot following by putting the players in charge of both the scheduling and what they did in game. And then also to make it a little more ad hoc and more malleable to the complex lives of adults.
Yep.
In terms of scheduling and whatnot. Yep. It's an interesting concept, right? So you imagine you set up this big sandbox, open world kind of place for players to explore. You have a big pool of players and you say, you know, well, when you guys want to go on an adventure, you know, form a party, come up with a goal and off you go. I ran a game like this myself, again, through with a group of people I was working with. So I was working at a company that was making, you know, online fantasy many player games. So like most of the employees were interested in seeing the tabletop roots of this kind of stuff. So I set up a West March's campaign where I said, okay, we've got a pool of like 20 people. We set up a wiki for them to record their characters and to record notes to each other, right? So that was sort of this. And anyway, and I set up this. I set up a map. The short story is actually just totally ripped off the Barbarian Prince map and reskinned it. And I had a plot around healing berries. So there was the plot basically revolved around is again in the article he says there's no plot and that's kind of true, but I had a recurring theme that you were in a boom town, right? You're in this little town out in the wilderness, and the interesting thing is discovered nearby there are these bushes that are growing these magic berries that are essentially just like good berries. So they heal. They actually heal. They have magical properties. And they're discovering that they can use these berries to, like, brew healing potions. This is actually how healing potions are made, and this is why you find them on the equipment list of the 5th edition Player's Handbook, according to me, in this campaign, because blah, blah, blah. And that was sort of like, you know, so the baseline thing they could do is like, well, we're going to go out and see if we can find, like, so all the berry bushes near the town are obviously picked clean at this point, so we're going to go explore further afield and see what we can find out about these berry bushes and where they grow. And maybe we can find a big lot of them. And I amusingly had, so here's the anecdote I wanted to share, Dan, that I was holding off from sharing pre-show. One of the records I kept for this game was called the Berry Index. And basically at the start of each game, I rolled randomly to see whether the berries had gotten a little more or a little expensive from the last time we played. And so the players nice. Always could go into the town and they could look at what are berries going for right now. And it fluctuated. And then I would influence this based on what the players, like if the players brought back a big load of berries, then okay, then the berries are going to, berry index is going to go down.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a funny little bit of business, and I have this very careful time record of each week, each game week, and how that affected the berry price.
That's neat. That's super neat. How long did that West Marches style campaign last?
So I'm looking at the berry index right now, and I can say that the first entry in the berry index is June 12th, and the last one is October 15th. So a couple months.
Okay.
A couple months.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. 3 or 4 months I ran this for. Again, I think it fell into the same pattern. I had a couple players who were really keen to play. Interestingly, in this case, and it's almost ridiculous that this kind of nonsense actually played to my benefit, but I had two players who really liked to play who didn't like each other. right.
This is new. Yeah. Wait, I've heard about this campaign, but this is actually a new piece of news to me. So
there you go. So classic, you know, classic D&D logistics problem. I have two players that kind of don't like each other very much. How do I deal with that? Well, so the answer is that they pulled other people from the group into this. So we basically kind of had two regular parties that were going out, right? Or at least it was always, you know, person A's party and person B's party, and who else was in the group changed, but they were kind of like the tentpole party members who were pushing to play and then dragging along. And so it almost became this point where, like, and they were kind of avoiding each other, so they were kind of like pushing the map, they were exploring the map in different directions, and they were like each kind of going down their own road to the point where I'm like, I kind of feel like I'm running two parallel campaigns that don't really have that much to do with each other, other than the fact that they're both linked in the same hometown.
Okay, fascinating. Yeah, cool. Now, somewhat similarly, the last comment, the second to last comment from Julian is that one thing that really helped him is that he scheduled in advance two meetings a week. And he's saying Tuesday and Thursday, and he's saying he could welcome any number of players at those sessions. And honestly, that actually answers a question for me about, like, okay, this is great having this free-form scheduling available to players, but I mean, you need the DM. So I assume, Paul, you blocked out like times that you were available for people to schedule sessions for that?
I did, but I tried to make them as flexible as possible, and it wasn't I'm always going to run a game every Thursday. It wasn't that. It did not become that. It was all right, these are generally the times in the future that I'm available if anybody wants to. It became like a sort of like an office hours kind of thing, right?
Okay. Yep.
I'm available for a game if you want to schedule one. Again, Ben Robbins posts about this in his blog post. He talks about the scheduling. He said like the GM has to be like hyper available, right? GM has to be super available for in order for this to work.
Right.
And then it also, the interesting thing is, you know, plot wise about West March is that it pushes responsibility on the players for like, well, what are we going to do? Right. It's not just, oh, we want to play on Tuesday. It's, well, I want to play on Tuesday so that we can go check out that goblin hideout that that we saw when we were out picking berries last week.
Right.
And then the DM has a little more focused of what to go in, zoom in on.
I like that a lot. I mean, I like that a lot. Now, of course, the DM has to have a enough campaign area prepared that there's interesting things to follow up on, obviously.
Yep.
But I like coming into the game and knowing that the players are pre-invested in what's about to happen that way. So it seems like that would...
This is getting a bit more into like what is sandbox style play, right? Because this is...
Right.
I would do this in my normal campaign. This is how I would run my normal campaign, which is a regular group where we're meeting every once a week, blah, blah, blah. But that is nice. In terms of like handling multiple groups, right? That's interesting, right? Like... I think the big issue we end up talking about, which I'm surprised you haven't brought up yet, Dan, is the timekeeping.
It's right? On my mind right this second. Yeah. I was like, I got to bring that up really soon.
Yeah. So, okay. Let's get it up here. Let's read it off.
This is, I know this is one of your favorite quotes, Paul, which is why I wanted it in the show today. You know, a lot of people, so here we're looking at the first edition DM's Guide written by Gary Gygax. And there's this whole major section just on time in the campaign, and it goes for like two pages. And one of our favorite quotes here is this bit in all caps in the second paragraph on screen that says, "You cannot have a meaningful campaign if strict time records are not kept." And again, that's a thing that some of us, the first time that we lay eyes on this, go, this doesn't seem to have any meaning whatsoever. What are you talking about? Are you talking about like setting up the calendar? But the truth is, the two pages that then proceed are entirely talking about handling multiple parties, is what that is. Mm-hmm. And particularly if you have one party that's operating in a dungeon on a hour-to-hour basis, and you have another party that's operating in the wilderness on a week-to-week basis, and time is literally flowing at different rates for the two groups, how the hell do you handle that? Plus, like, spell research and magic item creation, all that kind of stuff. And I find that one of the interesting things that Gary winds up saying there is what I think of as his no retcon rule, is he comes up with a situation, I don't know if he ever actually ran into this, whereby what happens if, you know, November 1st, play group A goes in the dungeon, kills a dragon, takes away a huge treasure. Okay. And then November 8th, party B goes in that dungeon, but in game time, they're operating sooner. Mm. So maybe party A went on a big wilderness trek, and in game time, they're later, but play group B is operating real time later, but in game earlier. And his solution to that is don't retcon what happened for play group A, just for play group B, announce that the cave is empty. And apparently the dragon has picked up the treasure and is traveling that week and is just not there. Which is a tough problem, right? It seems like, A, that seems sort of ridiculous. And B, it almost seems like, shouldn't I be rewarding the play group that's using less in-game time? But that was his solution, is even if one group is real-time early, in-game late, whatever they do sticks, and you just have to fly with that. But that's what that whole section is about. So the accurate time records is just purely how to deal with the multiple party issue and nothing else.
There's a kind of secondary problem that is very similar to this, though I think we did a show about once, Dan, which is like, what do you do when a player is not present, right? A player is sick or whatever and is not at the table. What do you do with their character? And I've seen that handled a dozen different ways. The reason I bring that up is West March pokes at both of these problems, right? Because not only, time flow may be different for different groups, but also, What if the playgroup is just fluctuating every session, right? West March is really tweaks this because it's like there's not even a standard party. There's not even just one party. There's whoever's here that night, which is pretty crazy. So there's a couple of things that I did, and I can't remember how much of this is West March's kind of by the book and how much of this is my own interpretation. But there were some things such as a hard rule of like, you have to return to town at the end of the session. Like, that's it. No. At the end of any given session, it is assumed the party returns to town. And, you know, if we just run out of real physical time, then I will just hand wave how you got back there. And I'll just, yep, blah, blah, blah happens, such and such, you're home. And that prevents the weird, like, whoa, last week Bob was here, now Charlie is here. That's weird. And then also, then as a sort of extension of that is that I assumed that that game time always progresses forward. So in between any two sessions, some amount of game time has passed. And this is like, I would just advance the clock more than just what the players did, right? Maybe the players spend a month of game time in a session. Great. I might say the next session starts 2 months in the future from there.
Yep.
But generally, the clock is always going forward. And so I never had to deal with, oh, this group actually technically arrives before that group. It just wasn't physically possible because there was a connection between real time and game time.
Got it. Yeah, and I'm very comfortable with that rule. I'm very comfortable with you've got to get back to town, partly so that I can hand wave the time issue. Frankly, it solves at least two problems. It solves the timing problem, and it also solves the who shows up next session problem. So I do that in my campaign. I see Julian saying that he does that in his campaign, and I'm very, very comfortable with that. And I feel like that does in fact solve a lot of issues. And the other thing that we have that you and I are both comfortable with is hand waving large amounts of time. So if we go a month has passed or 2 months have passed and we have, like in my campaign, I still have very slow healing rates naturally. You don't heal all your hit points overnight. It could take a month or two or something like that. If you're just resting, which is A, realistic, and B, actually allows more stuff to happen in the campaign. So I feel like, slightly modern play whereby you've leveled up a couple times in game in a couple days doesn't quite feel right. And I actually like being able to say that the campaign has experienced months or years of time of flow. And I feel like that gives a lot better texture, at least to the play that I'm familiar with.
There's, I think a problem comes into play here, especially when you have very large dungeons. Like, what if you're running a mega dungeon, right? I think inevitably you will have a session where the players like feel like they're gaining traction on a thing and just the real world clock runs out and they really don't want to return to town. They're like, no, we want to press our advantage. We're doing great. We really want to just pick up next session right where we left off.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't want to lose all this ground. And I think that makes sense to me because especially with large scale dungeons, you start to wonder, are they ever going to make it to the faraway parts of the dungeon?
It's interesting. I mean, I feel like, and of course for me, I'm like, you don't have a choice about it. You gotta go back to town. And if you want to do better, play faster next time. But for me, I feel like I tend to repopulate my mega dungeon slower than some other people. So once a thing is cleared out, it tends to stay empty for a longer amount of time than what some other people do. And personally, what I do is I just give one wandering check per level that you go down. So assuming that you've previously mapped and cleared out and know how to get there, on the way down to level 5, I just roll 1, 2, 3, 4 checks. That's it. To see if something has shown up on the prior levels and you can get back down pretty quickly has been my solution to that. How crazy. Now, one thing, John Miller in the chat is reminding us that some people use a dedicated return to town table. And I know that our friend BJ used to do that. So if the time in the real session times out and they didn't play through getting back to town, you roll on the what happened on the way back to town table. Now I don't actually use that myself. Have you used that, Paul?
I did briefly and quickly discarded it, especially because I think I was using Jeff Reince's actual tables, which I want to think include some pretty horrible things, including player death, right? Your character can die on that table. And I had a player rage quit over that. They were just like, what? I spent all this time and we played and I kept warning them, like, you're running out of time. Like, the session's going to end and you're going to be forced to go back. So you're going to, they always knew that the table existed, but until the reality, like, even at the moment, there was that kind of gambler, like, oh, it's going to be fine. I'm going to make it roll. What? I fucking died.
Right.
Table flip. I'm out. I'm out.
Right.
I can't
right.
believe I spent all this energy on this character and then, you know, died on a dice roll trying to make it back home.
Oh, that hurts. That's too bad.
Not happy. He was really not happy. That's too bad.
That hurts. So that answers John's question of like, at least some players were very not happy with that table.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yep. Fascinating. Yep. That's tough. Now, admittedly, okay. So the reason why I wanted to talk about this was, and it is a little bit different from the West Marches aspect, is what happens. The tough nugget for me is what happens if you have multiple separate parties and they want to interact or come in conflict or have a fight, right? Which again is why we started off with the wargaming idea of like you have two players and they need to schedule a Warhammer game or something like that. So mm-hmm. What so one one category of solution is to, as you and I were talking about a couple days back, is to literally have two games running live at the same time. So I might call this the synchronous method. Maybe you're a convention, and maybe you get like maybe two DMs, and you're actually running two sessions live in two separate rooms. Have you seen that happen before, Paul? Yep. And how does the interaction then occur?
I mean, of course I've seen that before because you and I played in such a game. I've seen a couple of times and I've tried to design a game like this. I'll tell you the classic one. I played a game at a convention where it was, I'm not even going to remember the systems properly. There were two different 40K Warhammer 40K, so that's the sci-fi version of Warhammer role-playing games. They focus on different things. I can't remember exactly. I'm not super familiar with all the different role-playing games set in that setting, but there was definitely two games that were set. They were basically using different systems, right? So they're using different systems, right?
Really?
One focuses on like Space Marines, I think, and one focused on more just sort of like ordinary people. I can't remember. Anyway, point being, turns out both groups were actually infiltrating or exploring the same area, the same building, right? And they're dimly aware that there's another group doing something. Like, something's happening in this building, and like a Space Marine Strike Force was sent here, and this group of investigators was sent there, and et cetera, et cetera. I think at some point, either we had the whole game or somebody was handed a walkie-talkie so you could actually communicate with the other group.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It sounds super exciting. How did it actually play? Not well at all. The walkie-talkie was just a distraction. Time was so out of sync between the two groups, it was laughable.
Yeah, right. Right?
And so it was just a distraction. It was just an extra thing that was like, well, this is annoying. I can't focus on that. I don't know what's going on over there. Whatever. There's another group, I guess. Whatever.
Yeah. Even if you have two games running simultaneously, they're still going to have the in-game time running at different rates, and you're still going to be out of sync.
Yeah, and through like the flow of like exploration versus combat, right? Like there's a time dilation that is wonderful. Frankly, it's a great perk mm-hmm. of these kinds of games that you can dilate game time. You're trying to keep two games in sync; it becomes a nightmare.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, so we've seen, so that I love the walkie talkie attempt, I guess I'll say.
Yeah.
I think that inspired the bringing into the telephone in one of your games at one point. Right.
Yeah. I have a horror game that's set in 1980s Berlin. And the original concept around this game actually was our friend of the show, Adam, he and I were going up to Carnage. Possibly he and I played in or were talking about the very Warhammer 40K game I was just discussing, and came up with this idea of a horror game set in 1980s Berlin, where you would have an East Berlin group and a West Berlin group. and then that they were linked by a telephone. And so we would actually have a physical telephone on the table that they could use to call each other, which was amusing. And I have all the technology to make that happen. But again, the problem of like just writing the content and trying to figure out how to link them in a dramatically exciting way, because that's what you want, right?
Right.
You want like it to be important that they can talk to each other. You want them to be able to do things that affect the game in some interesting way as a result.
Of course.
And we just couldn't make it come together. Eventually, what that devolved to was a game. It's just a single game with just me that has the phone as a prop on the table that the players still have to interact with, but they interact with to me as the DM and not another play group.
Right. And now the other case. So these things are all experimental. So I mean, the first time you run them, you're going to find out whether it works or not. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you mentioned, Paul, was this was 2 years ago at TotalCon. So TotalCon 2019, we played again with our friend Adam in a game that was being run by Jay Parker, who's a guy that runs a lot of Marvel superheroes games. And he has his own system you can find on DriveThruRPG called the G-Core system, which is kind of a simplified version of the 80s Space Rip Marvel system. And mm-hmm. So you and I and Adam got in a Marvel superheroes game that Jay was running that had about 10 people at the table. And this was in a room with about 5 different tables. And about 2 hours into it, it turned out that the Transformers game on the table next door, right, right next to our table, was being run by a friend of Jay's and was actually the same world happening. And so about 2 hours in, they actually connected the two tables, and we had a giant 20-player 2DM mashup with Marvel superheroes and Transformers fighting, a giant hideous monster. Which is funny because as I think about it, technically, Marvel Comics did publish Transformers at one point and did actually have Spider-Man show up in one. So actually, that is sort of canon, fanboys.
Yep. What did you think of that effect in that game? What was your takeaway from that? From playing that?
I thought it was cool. Now there were some other issues with the game that I'm not gonna lie. I've had 14 players at once, but having 20 players at once is a challenge for any DM. And the game was also kind of frankly low stakes. We everything that we ever fought, we very, very, very easily defeated. So if it had been me, I would have tweaked the challenge level a bit. That's kind of the thing that sticks in my head. Also, the fact that you and Adam are just wonderful role players. Like, I have never seen a better Mr. Fantastic and Ben Grimm played than by Paul and Adam. So I will. That actually is probably the number one thing that sticks in my head, is me just being agog at what a great Mr. Fantastic you played, Paul.
That's funny. I didn't think I was doing anything that special. So thank you, I guess. Of course, Adam and I have been playing together since college. So yeah, we know how to play off each other pretty well.
And I will say, in that case, when the tables came together, we were allied. It still wasn't player on player fighting. So we were allied against the big bad.
Is that a thing you want? You want that, Dan? Because this is reminiscent to me of a classic problem in D&D of what to do when there is player strife at the table. And I've seen this just at a normal weekly D&D game where just somebody's like, I'm playing a thief and I want to steal something from this other player. Right? Those conflicts come up and then there's some number of players who just hate that. Like, they're just like, I don't want that at the table at all. Why do I want that kind of drama at my table?
Okay, so the truth is, okay, totally understood. And a couple of people in chat, I think Ash was the first person to say that in these kinds of settings, a lot of people just come up with a no PvP rule and just take the issue right off the table. Within a party, I would be really aggravated by that as well. Then you're dealing with like your metagaming, and do I know that they did it, and do I not know that I did it? I feel like I'm a little bit more open to it when it's actually an opposing party. So I feel like if it's not someone that you're actually playing with directly, you know, I'll play a board game and I know that I'm going in opposition to the other people. And so I think that if that's already informed and consented in advance when you schedule the session, that I feel that player v player on with two opposing parties, I would be fairly open to that. Now, I'm not opposed to, you know, here I am thinking about, you know, Jay's Marvel Superheroes game, and there it's a lot less likely you're going to die outright. It's pretty likely you're going to get knocked down or unconscious and not actually lose your PC. I'm thinking about a convention game that's a one-off. So the stakes there are a lot lower than an ongoing, grinding, old-school D&D game where it's hard to level up your character. Then I understand, just like your player with the Return to Town table, I can understand that pain point a little better, actually.
Right.
But
right.
I feel like I want to be open to it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I don't mind a sort of like rivalry aspect. Like, I don't mind when the players are like, oh, I really wanted that thing and so-and-so got it. Or, you know, just little touches like that where it's clear, like, oh, the other party got here first and they did, you know, they did this thing. Mm-hmm. I don't mind that terribly. I'm not sure I would want to deal with like, you know, there's a MacGuffin and we need it. The other party has it. I sneak into their inn in the middle of the night and steal it.
Agreed. Yeah.
Because that's just going to escalate. Like that in what I just described probably sounds fine, but it's going to escalate and eventually it's all right, rumble in the streets time. And then we're just going to have a PvP fight.
Totally. Yeah, totally. So admittedly, I mean, I am thinking about like what, you know, how would one handle the PvP, which is the hard point. So obviously there's the, as we discussed at the start, there's the war game, like we'll make a special event. We'll make a special event and schedule it and come together and have the fight. A little bit like you did in your D&D campaign when your city got assaulted and I came in to run the bad guys.
Yep.
So I wasn't previously engaged in the campaign before that, but we had a special event for this non-DM player v player action, and that was an interesting event. Now the other thing that you know, looking through Tony Bath's book this morning, and this is totally how it worked in the old days for play by mail games or play by email games, is to have the fight rules working on a completely abstracted basis that the players don't actually interact when they have a PvP fight. So looking at Tony Bath's book, he refers to the judge as the umpire there, and he says the umpire fought the battles. So the players are operating at the strategic level, and they're moving armies around in his war game. And then when the armies finally come in conflict, that's entirely out of the player's hands. And the DM, the umpire there, entirely runs the battles on his own and then just informs the players later on of what happened. And I have participated in a game that worked like that. I was in a Marvel Superheroes game in high school that had, I think, about 20 players total in the campaign. And that's exactly what happened. And I said I was doing something with my character, and I just got a letter back the next day saying, you put up a good fight, but you lost. Now you're imprisoned or something like that. And that has problems because particularly if you're running a game system like D&D that has, you know, combat rules and you've built a character and you have feats and spells for particular things, it feels like it's taking a major element off the table. You know, maybe the player is then aggrieved that the DM didn't pick like tactically what they would have picked. And then if you have to come up with a whole separate system, does the system actually produce the same results as if you had the original fine-grained system? And that's a problem with, you know, people who try to use chainmail for mass combat. And then, like, the thing that bothers me is, okay, if I play it in normal D&D, I can fight 5 guys. But if I play it in this other system, suddenly I'm fighting 100 guys with equal proficiency. And that just doesn't seem right for the campaign at all. So you have that kind of problem, but a lot of campaigns have done that. You have a separate abstracted system that just entirely off screen determines the results of those fights.
You know, I feel like you and I have talked about, I know we have an episode where we talked about two DMs, right? Playing a game with two DMs. And I feel like we've talked about a situation before, which is a little less than two DMs, possibly, where you set up a sandbox campaign you're going to run with your players, but then you also have a remote person who is role-playing the villain, right? So you have like imagine me as DM running a campaign where I'm just adjudicating the rules and I have the whole sandbox set up and blah, blah, blah. But I've established that there's this major NPC villain that's being role-played by Dan, but not at the table. Right. Just the players do their thing. They go on their adventure. And then separately, I contact Dan and I go, OK, this is what the players did. Blah, blah, blah. What does your evil villain want to do?
Nice.
I think that would be a lot of fun. Honestly, I think that would be an interesting way to play the game. I think it would be difficult. I'm sure that you would throw horrible monkey wrenches that would be like, how do I make content for the players that's fun, that still also, you know, follows you know, what chaos Dan has introduced. But, this is sort of right. It's sort of similar, right? Where like the actual mechanics are being abstracted. If you assume that I'm playing a game with Dan as my one player, right? There is a game being played here where Dan, the supervillain, is a player. You know, there's then you're dealing with that abstraction. You're playing purely on the strategic level, right? You have no happens with the fights or. Right. Whatnot. I sent my orcs out to go invade this village, and this is what happened. Mm. Yeah,
that's a good. You know, maybe that's a good halfway point. Maybe you have one. Maybe that's a good halfway point to at least get started. Again, following Bath's principle of don't make it too complicated to begin with. Have one like normal D&D party that's playing everything in detail, and then have another person or party that goes in knowing that they're playing a more abstract game. And see how that interacts. I actually have used my partner Isabel for exactly what you're talking about, Paul. I guess no one's ever known this to date, but in the outdoor spoliation games, I actually would turn to Isabel and say, "Okay, now you are controlling this foreign power this year. Tell me what your foreign power wants to do against the players." So I guess I'm revealing something I never told anybody before, but some of the stuff that was happening behind the scenes was actually amazing machinations by Isabel. And I was sitting here with a notepad going, "Oh, that's great. That's terrible. I would have never thought of that. That's amazing." So I think it gave some nice texture to that game too.
That's funny. Inevitably though, the players are going to want to either interact with or fight that character, right? Yeah. You're going to have what you kind of want, right? Like, I want to do that. And I'm going to set that up and be like, great, we're going to have a special game. Dan's coming up. He's ready to play. Here we go. Yeah. Yeah. That would be interesting. I don't know. Have we answered the question for you at all, Dan? I'm kind of curious, like, what is the game you're setting up here? What's going on?
I'm going to keep under wraps for now. I read the old scrolls and I'm like, boy, it would be really fascinating to see what happens in a giant campaign like that with multiple, and I'm not saying I want the players to fight each other, but I mean, and I'll say this. So a long time ago in the chat, Ash Adler said that one of his favorite campaigns had two groups and they didn't know that they were two separate groups in the same campaign. They didn't know for an extended time. And I feel like that's exactly what I was thinking about a week ago of, wouldn't it be interesting to have two groups that actually don't know that there's two separate player groups, possibly in competition with each other. So that's the kind of thing I would like to have happen. And then, what happens when they want to either ally or come into conflict. I mean, I'm cool with either one.
There's a slight variation on this. I think that's a very small step towards this if you wanted to experiment with, which I did accidentally. Back in 2010, when I first got into old school D&D, I remember thinking, there are all these DMs out there who have these long-running campaigns, right, that they've been running for, you know, years or decades. I never had that experience, right? My campaigns are always very, very short, and then we nixed it and wanted to play something else. So I thought, I want to do this. I want to build a world, and I want the world to grow organically through play. So I'm going to leave a lot of it super vague and just write this little piece of the sandbox and then let the players impact the world and the world impact the players and expand out and expand out. So I did that for a while. And the interesting thing was that the play group did not remain consistent. Eventually, whatever happens, some players couldn't play. We had to switch what day we're playing, or like major upset where like the game didn't run for a couple of months. And then I started up a new game, but it was really just the same world and same rules, just with a new group of players. And so I kind of got that experience where like the world is persistent in my head. The world is persistent, and the players of one play group that happened later were seeing the impact of the earlier play group, right? The town has been modified group of players who have been to this town before. So the world had this very rich context to it. And so I was essentially dealing with multiple play groups in the same persistent world, just that they were completely non-parallel, right? They were like one group played all the way to the end, and then they stopped playing, and then a new group started playing. And they were completely, completely disparate like that.
That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, I even think I even had a case. I don't remember how much I pushed on this. I had a case where a player was unable to play anymore, left the group. His character had been involved with some vampires. And so eventually I turned his character into a vampire and was using his character as an NPC. And later he came back to play as a new character and had to deal with the fact that there was this vampire out there. That was technically his old character.
Right.
which is just delightful. That was my favorite part of that. Yeah. Honestly, my favorite part of that was that kind of stuff. Like I had one group who wanted a map of a certain dungeon. And I had a sage who said like, oh yeah, absolutely. I have a map for that. And like bartered them way up on the price and then handed them the maps played by the previous player group. I was like, good luck. And player maps are not great, as it turns out. Player maps are usually not great. And there was a lot of groaning over, like, what is this? Like, well, that's what they made. That's what the other adventuring party made. Sorry. Good luck with that.
I think we were laughing about that a couple weeks ago in how to make your game scary for October episode. Right? Where one of the most scary things is getting a different perspective on what used to be your own character. Being forced to rely on a horrible player made map. I guess maybe that's one of the most scary things of all.
Yeah. It's pretty funny. But my players got used to this, and it was funny because they would do things like if a player was like, I want to write a note or a letter to this NPC, I would say, you have to write it. You actually have to write it out and hand it to me.
Great. Great.
Because I'm gonna put that in the folder and that's gonna come back at some point. So that's super fun. Awesome. I would recommend play with that if you can. Play with that notion of like, you know, maybe you don't have a regular play group and you're just running a series of one shots, but like put them in a persistent location and let them, you know, it's a nice way to like sort of experiment with this just a little bit.
Nice. Yeah super. Cool. All right. Well, I still will be juggling this. So if people want to continue the chat in the YouTube comments later on with whether they think it's best to keep PvP, take it off the table, schedule a special event for it, abstract it for the referee off the table, some other thing that hasn't occurred to us, I would be interested in hearing that.
Great. Dan, do you have any personal final thoughts on the topic?
I want to see this. I don't know. I still don't know how I would do it. I feel like right at the moment I might be forced to do the abstracted fight bit if I had, you know, because it was already so hard. So much of this comes from our war game experience, right? And, you know, our reading of like these big complicated, you know, campaigns that are going for years, right, as we said at the beginning, and, you know, John reminded us again recently here, you know, so much of this comes out of the war game experience that sort of accidentally spawned role-playing for Dave Arneson and David Wesley and people like that. And as John Peterson said, we have been failing to war game for a long time now.
Yeah,
but I think right at the moment, I might possibly steal Tony Bath's idea and say, I'm going to abstract it away. If it's hard enough to schedule a special event for two people playing Warhammer, I probably can't even begin to imagine that I could get like eight people together for a special event for two D&D parties fighting. So I might possibly abstract it away.
Just abstract it. Yeah.
But then I might have the event of your player having abstracted the how to get back to town being super upset about it. So maybe that's a big mistake.
I think it depends too on like the content you're writing and how the conflict came up, right? Is it just a random thing that happened during play? If one player gets angry at what another group did and they like say, all right, I'm just going to kill that guy. I'm just going to go knock on his door and, you know, shoot him in the face with my magic missiles. I think you have to abstract that because you're not going to be able to schedule that just on the fly. Whereas on the other hand, maybe if you have some ability to predict, right? And you're like, the arc of this campaign is there's going to be this big climax thing at the end and they're all going to want to be in the same place at the same time. And maybe you can like pre-schedule that. Say like, I'm gonna have this big gaming party. We're on such and such date. Maybe you can put a little effort to sort of make it happen. But then you're kind of forcing it, right? Now you're kind of forcing it, and it's not happening organically through play, and maybe that's less exciting. I don't know.
I suppose you could schedule it, and you could have like people agree to have their characters run by other players. Like maybe there's, you know, a subset of the actual player group, but they're controlling other characters if they're okay with that. I suppose that's a modification of that idea.
Interesting.
Like you're talking hardcore caller, right? The parties only send the caller lead to the event, and the caller runs all the player characters at the special combat.
Oh, jeez.
How about that?
Yeah.
I think nailed it. Gonna like that. I'm so glad I found the solution. Woohoo!
good luck with that, players. Experimented with this, have other experiences about multiple groups in the same game world, and we'd love to hear from it. Leave us some comments here in the YouTube chat, and Dan's clearly still got questions. Hopefully we'll revisit this, Dan, once you've had a chance to actually run a thing.
We can do the autopsy after it blows up in my face. And of course, if you're new to the show here, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs, and we're on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and also, yes, GitHub, and we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites, so look for us there for updates and upcoming shows.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, that is available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find it through various podcast carriers such as Google Podcast, iTunes, and Spotify. If you're listening to this show on one of those sites right now, please take a moment, rate and review our show on that site. That helps other users of that site find us and grows our audience, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DM shows. And if you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You see a couple different tiers. We have discounts on merch, access to our private Discord server, monthly behind-the-scenes videos, polls, and surveys we try to do, and after-party chat every Sunday after our main show. And we'll be there on our Discord server in about 10 minutes after the show to continue the conversation there. More upcoming shows. Paul will be back with more 10 Dead Rats tomorrow, Monday, at 8 p.m. Looking for schedule more wargaming on Saturday if my in-house partner here wasn't so busy. You know, Paul, I don't know if you know, but scheduling is hard. Scheduling games is hard, indeed. Even with just two people.
It is. Look how much we warp the rules of the game just to work around the scheduling problem. Holy cow.
So we'll continue to work on that. But don't forget, one thing you can depend on is that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.